Welcome to Explainable AI, where demystifying digital minds is your personal journey into the heart of artificial intelligence. I'm Paul Anthony Claxton. I'm an AI venture capitalist and serial entrepreneur. After a decade of service in the Marine Corps, I was captivated by the power of battlefield technologies, and that really inspired me to dive deeper into the world of technology. My commitment today is to make a meaningful difference and to continue to serve in ways through my business endeavors, which has ultimately led me into venture capital, where I view capital as a really powerful tool to drive positive change. As a recognized thought leader in AI and venture capital, I regularly share my insights and whatnot through podcasts like this one and by writing and doing blogging on various platforms and publications such as ideascale.com and the AI Accelerator Institute. You can learn more about me by going to my CV site, which is www.paulclaxton.io. From there, I'd like to introduce you to my co-host as well, Rowan Hall. Rowan?
Hey, thanks, Paul. I really appreciate it. So my name is Rohan Hall, and I'm the co-host of this podcast, Explainable AI. I am a serial entrepreneur and an advocate for conscious entrepreneurship. My focus is on teaching businesses how to integrate AI for greater efficiency and growth, while also founding the Ninja CEO Foundation to bring AI education to underserved communities. I'm also excited to launch Podcast Monster. Yay! It's a cool new platform designed to help podcasters to turn their content into organic content that can help them with distribution of their podcast and monetization as well. So thank you. And you can always reach me at rohanhall.com. That's Rohan Hall, first name, last name, .com. Thanks.
Great. Well, thanks for having me, folks. My name is Joe Mayberry. I am an edge AI expert focused on smart cities, safety, security, and public sector. What that means is I work to design and build solutions from the chip level that are deployed outside the data center and are not personal computers. So think anything that's in a retail store or a healthcare office or hospital, but specifically smart cameras, street infrastructure, event infrastructure, the things you would interact daily on your commute to and from work if you still commute, and when you participate in your urban environment. So thanks for having me. I appreciate it and look forward to the conversation.
Thanks, Joe. It's really good to have you here. So just one of the things, we've got so much to talk about today, and one of the things that the first things that I wanted to cover and get your opinion on, your perspective on, Joe, is urban air mobility, the integration of urban air mobility capabilities into smart cities. So, you know, this makes me go back to my time in the Marine Corps. By nature in the Marine Corps, my job specialty was anti-air defense operations, right? So protecting various installations, compounds, personnel against enemy air capabilities, right? So I was trained to shoot down fighter jets and attack helicopters with Stinger missiles. But additionally, I did operate, you know, kind of on the defense side of the aviation sector and the Marine Corps. Additionally, I had other opportunities to serve in collateral assignments where I ran like command operations intelligence centers, which is where I got like my first exposure to air mobility, air defense on the other side, like drones and the capabilities of drones and what they can do for us, you know? And so when it comes to smart cities, we may not necessarily be looking at, air mobility or drone mobility capability in terms of defense. We may be looking at it from like last mile logistics, supply chain logistics, rendering air and aid to care and aid to people that may be stranded in remote locations and so forth. So these are interesting things to think about. In your mind, Joe, how do you envision urban air mobility is transforming our lives and our city landscapes and infrastructure?
It's a really good question. I think just opening that question up a little bit, there's a lot of different compartmentalized ways to look at it. There's the really light aircraft, the drones, the Amazon deliveries, the EMS delivery, the police oversight, the fire, urban fire oversight that occurs with these really tiny drones that we're used to seeing around. I think we're going to see a lot more in the air. So that's one compartment. The other is UAM, urban air mobility, really thinking about the couple of kilometer range, right? So 50 kilometers and below. And that's your futuristic Jetsons, right? Where I'm taking off instead of a helicopter from the top of a New York skyscraper, I'm on an apartment building that's much lower, and I have four different urban air mobility stations on top of that apartment complex, and I can rent space in one of those to get to work in the future. And we have these kind of quadcopter type devices. There's lots of companies working on these and different types. It's kind of fun. And we're getting in there and we're commuting to different places or we're using them for business travel, or there's a rideshare service. That's kind of this urban air mobility. Then there's the regional air mobility, and that's autonomous flight up to 150 kilometers or a little bit further. The market hasn't really decided where that goes and how far that goes, but there's quite a bit of money there. So if we think of those three from small, medium, and large, we can break down and have a discussion around that in each section. But let me just focus for now on what I think you guys had alluded to. You may want to talk a little bit more about, which is that urban air mobility right in the middle, not the drones, not the autonomous regional flights, but that urban air mobility, quadcopter, taxi, helicopter, taxi kind of a thing. There's a lot of really interesting things to consider when we look at what the future will be with those types of technologies and when it will be. So I'll let you guys ask any questions if you want, but I want to talk to you probably about the main issues that I see as a technologist in this space that actually have nothing to do with technology, that are going to basically define how this grows up. The first is power. We've seen recently with Three Mile Island investments and the smaller nuclear reactors being vested from an AI perspective from those big companies that we all know, right? Microsoft and Amazon, that power is a major issue. But it's not just the generation of power for these new devices. It's the ability to run the infrastructure to the locations, the physical locations. You know, typically when we think of flying, we go to an airport, and an airport has all the infrastructure required for flights, including safety and security and being able to access and permissions and who's getting on the flight, all of that. And it's all contained, and it's been developed over hundreds of years. And so now we have this new era that can put an equivalent of a small aircraft on top of a building, and the ability to get power to that to recharge and get power to it to make sure that it's running at safety checks and connectivity. That's a lot of infrastructure. And so in my mind, that power and that physical infrastructure of landing sites and where to put them is actually going to be the primary thing that drives adoption and scale of these devices. And I didn't know if you guys had any questions you wanted to talk about that, or any stories or any articles you may have read, but for me, that's really the main issue with these: the technology of how to fly, being autonomous in flight, tracking, all that is, in my opinion, easily surmountable issues. It's really the infrastructure and the laws of getting these quadcopters or whatever they may be in the right place to make urban mobility a reality. It really seems to be the primary barrier.
As you're saying that, it makes me think about a follow-up with that, which is, so living in LA and other large cities, right, the question is always, if you're having, it's kind of like, we have enough traffic on the ground in LA, right? Are we going to have traffic in the air like that at some point, where everyone now has a little Jetson, car to fly and zip-zap around, right? And what kind of regulations are being had? Do you see that as being a constraint as well?
Yeah, so it's really interesting because you know, let's think of the reasons of that. You know, no one likes sitting in LA traffic. I went to UCLA for a couple of years in grad school, and I lived in Westwood and tried to get on the 405 to go anywhere, and it was impossible, right? Unless you're traveling, you know, in the middle of the night or very, very early in the morning. But a lot of that exists, quite frankly, because we don't have autonomous vehicles. And once you have autonomous vehicles, you will have significantly reduced traffic flow issues. And you will have additional ride sharing opportunities that make it economical to use autonomous vehicles for ride sharing. And so when you think of UAMs or individual Jetson flying vehicles in your backyard, taking off on a landing pad, right? Do I need to go pour, you know, an 8x8 landing pad in my backyard? I don't think so. Because I think the impetus to have those really will start to dissipate as time progresses. Now, it does not mean that they won't be available and useful. So for example, if we go back to kind of various use cases, you know, we've been talking about personal mobility, commuting or moving within a city. And there may be need for that for individuals, and it will probably be a very small portion of the market in my mind. But what we also have, which is really important, is emergency access. So imagine there's a hazmat spill in downtown LA or downtown Chicago, and you need to get to it quickly with very specific equipment. Well, these types of urban air mobility devices that are you know, used by government entities to resolve those emergency issues, you can imagine those being very quickly fast-tracked because every second counts. Same with emergency ambulance and airlift, right? These are a lot of use cases where a lot of the red tape of just the general public flying around will go away because it becomes a part of the EMS system, both from from a urban standpoint, but also from a rural standpoint when you think about trying to get people in rural areas. And so there's a lot of usefulness for these devices when it comes to specific use cases where the public can immediately see the value that's going to come from it. And if you were to ask me where I think we're going to come out with those first, and by the way, I'm a generalist, so I am not an urban air expert. Okay, I'm a generalist when it comes to edge AI use cases in smart cities. I believe that the EMS system, the utility systems, the government entities that will recognize incredible savings and improved citizen welfare by the use of these assets are the ones that are going to get them approved and deployed fastest. Can I give an example?
Yeah, please.
So I currently live in Arizona, and there's a university here that uses large drones on predetermined tracks to be called by students to walk them home. So if you're a young lady taking a very late class, this thing will literally walk you home with a large spotlight as necessary, and as acting as a security.
What do you mean walk you home?
So the student will leave their classroom, they can call the drone, and it will follow them and be with them as an escort.
In flight, follow them. Clear about that.
Yep, and it has a little deterrent, you know, blue light, and has a spotlight as well. And so this is going on in a beta stage at one of these universities around here. So there's a lot of various use cases. That's a smaller one, but there's a lot of these various use cases that are coming up that are just obvious. And from a regulation standpoint, those ones which just seem so clear in the normal human populace from a value perspective are the ones that I believe are going to get passed through very quickly. And so over time, we're going to see more and more comfortableness. That's not even the right word, guys. I don't even know what the right word is. Societal willingness to accept flying things above them. And that's what we're really looking for.
Yeah, I do one more follow-up and I'll let you go, Paul, after that. So we're talking about the concept of smart cities, And we talk about Jetsons, you know, for people that's old enough to remember the Jetsons, right? Which won't be everyone here. Before we continue, I'd just like you to, if you could define what our current definition is of smart cities so the audience can be on the same page for us, I think that would be really kind of cool. And then you speak about we'll be more comfortable with stuff. And one of the things that comes into mind is really crowd monitoring. So yes. I go to like a football game or I go to a concert. There's, you know, is that what we're doing for crowd monitoring? Is it some laser eye someplace? Is it drones flying around? So how are we doing that? So two, we could define what smart city is and then just a follow up with, it's what are we doing for crowd monitoring? Is it like what you spoke about with the lady or something? Just because we're, because I think this is really cool and fascinating, but I'm trying to link my brain with where are things today versus, you know, Jetsons, right? Because I can't like not think about the Jetsons, right? So please go ahead.
I got you. No problem. So first of all, smart city does not have a universal definition. So my purview is global, right? So we work with folks, in Dubai, in India, in China, in Taiwan, in the United States, South America. We're all over the place is what I focus on. And so anywhere you go, there's no one definition of smart city. And that has to do with how infrastructure is funded amongst various nation states. However, what I would say is at a high level, it is the deployment of technologies today, specifically artificial intelligence, as well as connectivity technologies to improve citizen welfare. That's probably the most accurate for a universal definition of what a smart city is. And you will notice that I don't apply a urban density or an urban definition to that. And that's because a lot of the smart city has to be rural applicable. Otherwise, you know, the line of where the city ends and where the country begins or the rural areas begin is really blurred. And quite frankly, after COVID, it's being further blurred. Super commutes are getting longer and people are doing and working from home much more often. So in any case, let's get to crowd monitoring. Crowd monitoring is an interesting use case. We see this as a highlight use case, at least I do, most everywhere, because wherever there's a lot of people at one time, there's both opportunity and risk when you put a bunch of people together, right? I don't know about you guys, Paul, you're in the Marines. I was in the Air Force. I have little kids. You know, I teach them when we go hiking what to do when they're lost. Hiking, you know, hug a tree, sit down, blow your whistle three times, standard stuff, right? But I also teach them what to do in a crowd if you're lost. Do you just go with the crowd? Do you move to the side? What do you do? Because crowded environments can be dangerous, but they're also highly lucrative. People are there for a reason. They want to go to a concert. They want to go to a stadium. And so one of the big things that cities are focused on is how do we make those crowded events safe? And how do we make them lucrative for everybody, both the vendors that are there and the people that are there? How do we give them the very best experience? And so crowd monitoring has multiple aspects that does this. And let me paint a picture for you with a stadium. Let's say people are at a stadium for a concert or a sporting event, okay? Crowd monitoring can be used at multiple levels. So we'll start with safety, and then we'll kind of go to the more retail and commercial, and we'll do the citizen welfare. So from a safety perspective, yes, when you go to a crowded event like a stadium, there's going to be different cameras using computer vision that are tracking individuals. And depending on the privacy compliance of that particular region, they may not be using cameras at all. They may be using LIDAR. LIDAR is really good for tracking large numbers of individual unique entities, but without the concerns of actually having a picture of that person. So think of like if you're in an airport terminal or coming quickly into an arena and people want to track how many individuals are coming in there so they can make sure they understand the volume of flow and redirecting people into the right areas of the stadium appropriately. That's a perfect use case for LIDAR or computer vision cameras. And so what you're doing is there are going to be some security apparatuses behind that. Look, either humans in the loop or algorithms that are doing aggression or weapons detection or argument detection, anomaly behavior, things that you would want your security staff to know about to be able to respond to immediately. You know, someone pushes somebody trying to get in and the scuffle starts, right? You don't want that going out of control. You don't want a stampede of people. And so you want to know about that as soon as possible so you can send your security as an example. Let's go next to the next crowd monitoring. Which
before you continue, you threw a couple of words out there. I like to break down words every once in a while because many people may not get it. Can you explain the difference between computer vision and LiDAR?
Oh, yeah. So computer vision is a broad term for artificial intelligence applied to camera-based visual feeds. So think of the camera we're on right now. You can see my face. And you can do quite a bit with that. You can do all different types of base analysis of the image. You know, are there multiple people here? So people counting, who are they? Do I have an ID that I want to gather? And most of the time, by the way, that is only done in prescribed area where people have surrendered rights to have them their PII provided. But in any case,
PII.
A personal identifiable information, right? So the type of stuff.
I'm doing this because I know that we do this tech talk, and I just want to, as we go along, because the audience may or may not get that, but please continue.
You're absolutely, thank you. Yeah, so the personal information, right, about you. So you're able to do weapons detection, so it can determine whether or not someone has a gun that they're holding or a knife that they're holding that you would want to know about, right, as a security professional. So these things can be done through computer vision. LiDAR is like radar, but it is a little bit more sophisticated, and it's a completely different sensor. It's not a camera, it's an actual LiDAR sensor. So a lot of people may be familiar because there are certain autonomous vacuums. Remember when autonomous vacuums came out? Some were computer vision based with a regular camera, and some were LiDAR based with a LiDAR and allowed them to map out the environment and where they go. Another example is if anyone's seen autonomous vehicles, almost all autonomous vehicles, not Teslas, but almost all autonomous vehicles use LiDAR when they drive around. So like I said, I live in Arizona. We have autonomous vehicles driving around in the streets of Arizona as autonomous taxis at the moment. And they the little spinning device on top of it, if you've ever seen pictures of that, that's LiDAR. And LiDAR is useful because it's not a camera. It's not capturing my image. But it is able to uniquely identify me and the thousands of other people walking through the door of the stadium. And so I'm able to track in as without sacrificing personal information, I am able to track how many individuals I have. Any other questions on the security part before I kind of go to the retail portion?
No, please continue.
So in addition to crowd monitoring, you have all these retail applications, right? So if you're at a stadium, the stadium wants you to buy food and drink and you're thirsty and hungry. So it's a match made in heaven, right? So as you're able to look and see who is sitting where, you're able to identify the number of people and how many venues, eating venues or whatever it may be, or food beverage venues need to be open on what side of the stadium. So you're able to dynamically change wait times as necessary and provide push notification to those citizens and say, hey, look, you know, there's nobody at the hot dog stand in gate A6, right? You can go there and get a hot dog or whatever you're looking for at the stadium. And so there's a lot of retail analytics that come into it as well. So you can do automatic line detection with cameras looking down and seeing how many people are in line. You can auto push that right to those who subscribe to a particular application or however you want to deploy that information. It's very useful. You also have demographics, right? So if you know exactly the type of demographic individual that's going to go procure a beer versus a cotton candy, right? You're able to more appropriately position your vendors so that they make optimal income. And so do you and your customers have the very best experience because when my beer will want a cotton candy, I'm going to be able to get one nearby. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of benefit there for both the citizens as they attend the event and the customers as they attend the event and the event venue and those who are keeping it secure.
But a follow-up for that, but you would need to have the mobile. Are you connecting with the mobile number? Or are you connecting by presenting a layer in on the big screens or something like that? How do you communicate that to the citizens?
So connectivity is key. And what you're talking about there is the ecosystem play, right? So if we gather this information, first it's data, then it's information. Now I need to turn it into action, right? Mm-hmm. And the answer to your question, Rohan, is it depends. It completely depends on who's there. If there's an independent application that a stadium uses for anyone who comes so that they can get optimized coupons or whatever it may be, that's the perfect way, right? You're able to interact with a customer and they're a loyalty customer. That's wonderful. There may be other ways to do it, which is simply not have any communication and appropriately place your vendors and your mobile vendors where they need to be, as an example, where there's little to no communication. And the revenue generation and the satisfaction of the customer is aligned to the level of granularity by which you as an individual can communicate with the entity that is delivering the service. And so it really is dependent on the ecosystem of vendors in that microcosm, that small space, right? And you can imagine it going the other way around. Like if you open it up, like let's just open up the thought process as say, my town here in Arizona has a system that I can text when there are issues just in the street. Hey, there's a irrigation issue on street XYZ, and it's obviously, in the middle of the median and it's shooting water out. I can report that immediately, right? So there's all different avenues by which cities and stadiums and event centers and corporations and others communicate with their customer or their constituents or their citizens. And once the information is gathered, it's up to those who are in charge of that those particular entities to determine how best to deliver on that information.
That's very cool. Yeah, that's super cool. Because what you're saying is that I think as a citizen, I am not really thinking that my city is really directly connected to me. But I know that they are. Like I'm in California, that there's like a fire and you get this big loud thing from your phone. I'm like, how do they know to send it to me? Right. Yeah. Meaning that they must have a way to know my specific mobile number versus someone that lives in LA, right? Because I live in Orange County. So it seems like one of the main components that you're saying here is a communication piece of it between the entities that are governing and the residents that are being governed as well, whether it's on a more larger scale city or state, or a much smaller scale, you go to a concert or something like this, right?
Absolutely. You've got the picture perfectly. And one of those, the big challenge is, in my mind, well, not the biggest challenge, but a primary one, is exactly what you described. It is the ability to connect with the citizen and make sure that they understand that they're receiving certain services, and that citizen understands that they're paying for those services through their taxes, and that they and the value that they're receiving. And it creates a much better citizen value and community value exchange. And I think it's wonderful, quite frankly. I think there's a lot of benefit that comes through it. And the last thing is, US citizens specifically are, and European citizens as well, are very concerned with privacy. And there is a level of surrendering when it comes to privacy for that value exchange. And I think it's incredibly important that everyone understands and that each citizen understands what they are surrendering, and that legal structure is set in place and it is voted upon and delivered at the behest of the citizens. And so fundamentally, philosophically, that is very important to me as a citizen. And so one of the benefits, the silver linings of technology advancement, is because it does make very apparent the use of private information, as you just described, Rohan, it will engage you as a citizen into what your city is doing and engage you in the environment to make informed voting decisions as well, which once again encourages interaction and investment in your community, which I think is a wonderful thing across the board.
Sorry, Paul. I have to do one more follow-up. Because as you say that, right, I can't not think about that being abused as well by the government, right? So, you know, I'm not one of these crazy guys that think the government's going to take over. I'm not, but I'm from the blockchain world, so I surround myself with a lot of those guys. And like, if they listen to this, they're going to say, "Holy crap, dude!" Like, you know, I don't want the government to identify me so individually. I don't want them to know where I am. I don't want them to be monitoring me. I don't want them to, because now you're collecting all this data about me, my whereabouts. There's the Will Smith movie. What was it?
The iRobot?
No, not that one. When they were chasing him and yeah.
Enemy of the State.
Enemy of the State. Yeah, that one, right? And you kind of get that feeling that you can't escape anywhere you go, right? And we kind of know, like, if I'm in New York, if I'm in London, right, I know that there are the cameras everywhere. And so you kind of, but in the USA, we don't feel that, right? We don't feel like we're being watched. But what you just said is that we are, okay? And but really, that's what you just said. It's like, you just really said that, hey, Rohan, you know what? Everywhere you go, the technology does exist today, and it's probably being utilized, and we are believing, and I think rightfully so, that it's being used in the proper, non-intrusive, non-abusive way. But likewise, we have the history of the planet that governments have abused those kinds of power. So sorry, I'll do this last point and then I'll let Paul take over. So for people that would be concerned about that point, what do you say to them?
I think it's incredibly important that everyone make that connection and vote and engage in their community appropriately. I am all for the appropriate engagement of citizens to drive the technology where they want it and where they don't want it. I think exactly what you described is a touch point for a lot of people, and I think they should make that connection and engage. It's not like only the government has this. It's not like we've invested in some NASA go to the moon big thing that only the government, the US government has, or the, you know, a certain government has or not. There's a great use case I saw of smart connected glasses, touching back to a couple of licensed databases for personally identifiable information, PII. It was a student at a university in California, and they were able to walk around, and the camera on the smart glasses would see somebody on the street, would skim social media, as well as those proprietary data, probably using some sort of RAG-based analysis, and bringing back with a high probability that person's name, where they lived, any facts about their friends or school, and that individual would go up and ask them and say, "Hey, are you so-and-so? Did you work on the NATO proposition for XYZ? Did you write a paper on XYZ last year? I'm a big fan." And this is a student. This is a undergrad. I believe they were undergrad. Maybe they were graduate level student at a California university, created this with complete open source information. It's not like some government entity is holding this. It exists and it's out there.
You can use
the barriers to entry are near zero.
For people that want to hack this, you can just go buy a Ray Ban and connect it to a rack system, or you could do that. Okay, I'll move on.
Paul? Okay.
Yeah, you can do that today. Yeah. Paul, do you want to follow?
Yeah. No, I've enjoyed listening to you guys kind of banter back and forth. It's really, you know, got my mind accelerating towards a lot of different questions and, you know, points that I can make. We probably don't even have time for it all. But one thing that I did want to lead into, you know, all this talk about connected smart cities and security, you know, the more connected we are, the more centralized and urban we are as a society, the more security becomes, I think, you know, a concern, right? Not just physical security, but cybersecurity as well, because there's more interactions taking place in a denser, higher per capita area, right? So I think that's those things are important as we become more urban centric as a society. I think we're going to see kind of more interconnected metropolises. So like, you know, say from LA to San Diego or, you know, LA to Phoenix, I think we're going to see, you know, more focus on how we can connect these major cities via railway and take cars off the road. And I think we're already beginning to see kind of the breeding ground, the testing phase of many of these railway technologies and kind of railway way of life, you know, evolving. Like for example, I was in Dallas, flying through Dallas a couple months ago, and I was on the light rail connecting all the terminals at the Dallas airport, and there's no one operating the train. It just operates on its own per a schedule, and you know, autonomous you know, capability via algorithms and whatnot. So you know, these, you know, things like trains are being tested in controlled environments like that, and pretty soon I think we're going to see it more common, you know, towards the public. So you know, Joe, my question to you would be, you know, with America, at least in North America, we're kind of shifting our focus more from air travel, more from, you know, road travel to, you know, urban air mobility, autonomous vehicles, removing the human from the decision-making point, autonomous trains, et cetera. And we've seen, I think if you scour the news, we've seen a lot of derailments, train derailments, issues with this, you know, challenges that are existing with this transition to more of autonomous mobility, particularly with trains. So do you have any ideas or thoughts in terms of like how we can make this transition easier? Because that's ultimately where we're headed. And I think in some ways, societies like Japan are ahead of us, you know, in a lot of ways with the transition to, you know, train mobility. So how can we, you know, as we look to connect cities and get people from one city to the next, you know, on a hyperspeed kind of train infrastructure loop, what are some challenges that you see or the things that we can address to get from point A to B, point B proverbially, you know, into the next evolution of travel here?
No, that's great. That's a great question too, specifically about trains. You know, I travel often from Arizona to Southern California, and we go along the 10, and the 10 goes straight through Palm Springs, and we always see massive trains going right through that pass. And I always point out to my kids to say, "Hey, look, every one of those containers is a semi truck that's not on this highway." Yep. You know, that's how many trucks we don't have to pass or try to get around. And they always think that's pretty funny. And I always point that out because it really is astounding the amount of goods that we can move to and from our ports with our rail systems. And, you know, most of them are not, you know, maglev trains. You know, I don't even know if there's any, quite frankly, futuristic. What they are is traditional, you know, diesel based, I believe, trains. And one of the things that we see as, or I see as a value proposition with some of this new technology, this edge AI technology, is the application on existing infrastructure to make it safer. So for example, I think there was and I don't have the facts in front of me, so you have to forgive me if any of this is inaccurate, but I believe in the train that derailed in Palestine was a wheel that had somehow overheated.
Yeah.
And that caused a derailment. You know, that type of issue can be resolved, and there's a use case I'm aware of that monitors the temperature as well as the wheel itself, or the particular infrastructure that was deformed, with computer vision applications, with a camera there on board the train. That's very, very cheap to deploy. The contents of the compute and the infrastructure itself is relatively inexpensive, and the compute nodes are fewer, because it's just a real simple analytics being run on a very simple camera, and so that's the type of thing that a smart city type solution could be applied to a rail system that goes between urban and rural environments to maintain safety with existing infrastructure. So the first is kind of, all right, what do we do to improve our existing infrastructure? The other piece is the major choke points, right? Anyone who's take ops research is you put all your resources behind the major choke points. And a lot of the times, the major choke points are the actual ports themselves. Getting containers on and off ships. And so I'm going to combine these two kind of use cases, because I think they're so relatively similar. Is making sure that those the inventory of those containers are tracked autonomously and verified, either with a human in the loop or not, depending on the requirements of the nation state or the companies that are involved, and delivering those goods more quickly by ensuring verification. And then when you extend that to all modes of transportation, you know, you have trucks coming in to ports as well, and they need to ensure that the appropriate driver is in the driver's seat, and the certified driver and the certified truck is going in there, and it's carrying the right thing, and it has the right placards for whether it's hazardous material or not, and whatever it may be. And a lot of that is also resolved through edge AI computer vision solutions, identifying those placards, identifying those drivers, confirming identities, those types of things, and doing it in a much faster manner than previously established. And so you're having more efficiencies and you're having safer operations through the deployment of these edge AI solutions in both ports and rail. And I see that as a major thing we can start doing right now, and that a lot of people are doing right now, but something that we can focus on as a meaningful way to assist the transition to better use of our aging infrastructure.
That's super cool. I have to do a follow-up, of course. So even though I focus a lot on AI, I spent years building blockchain technologies. And one of the things I built, I don't know, years ago, this is, I think IBM was the first, the company that I, we were like the second. We built a what's called a blockchain traceability platform. And what that means is that you can trace products from anywhere to anywhere throughout an entire supply chain using different blockchain technologies, right? And so this was really just one way to verify and validate authenticity of the products. But once you get to a port of entry, or, you know, because you can trace it across the world, right? But when you get to a port of entry, then that's where there's a lot of fraudulent stuff, because what you just explained, that was something that was not really possible a few years ago. How do you really verify at the port that the product is what you think it is, that the shipper is who you think it is, that yep. So, and I know that the Department of Homeland Security, because we were doing some things at the time with them, this is a few years ago, that was one of the problems that they were trying to solve. So what you're saying now, I'm going to also ask you to do another definition. Sorry, I'm going to call it the little definitions, right? You mentioned edge computing, right? So I want you to explain that to everyone else as well, because that's an important part of the solution, right? So you're saying now that you can use edge computing, and you can use computer vision, you can use a combination of different AI technologies to solve that step in the global supply chain problem of fraudulent products and fraudulent people and stuff like that. So the blockchain, I think, is still a really great piece of that for the traceability yep. part. And then yes. you're saying that AI would be a really great piece for the verification and validation part. So can you just explain that a little bit, and also start out with explaining what edge is, so other people can also get that phrase into their vocabulary?
Sure. And once again, I that's an industry phrase. So defining edge, The way I define edge is anything that's not in the data center or not a personal computer. So traditionally, this business was known as the embedded business. Think of it as, you know, your point of sale device when you check out at a Target or a Walmart or another store or a restaurant. Think of it as medical imaging devices that are doing medical imaging for you. There's compute, high levels of compute in there. Think of it as security cameras, anywhere you want to be. Think of it as dynamic mobile order. So you're ordering at a McDonald's or at another restaurant where they have a tablet there, and you're ordering there. There's a level of compute that's required. They're going to start to, I don't know if this is not me saying McDonald's will do this. I have no idea what they're going to do, but I would imagine restaurant chains are going to start incorporating cameras for loyalty ID, for you to be able to have your usual and not have to go through the entire. So this type of ease of use, this type of edge compute that uses AI, not in the data center, not at a PC, but where you are, where you work, where you play, where you eat, that's what I mean by edge compute. And it has to do with the topology of compute. There's the data ingestion point, which could be a camera or a microphone or a soil sensor or anything, right? Then there is the, we'll call it mid-tier compute, where you have all of those sensors that then, you know, this is the old IoT, Internet of Things focus. You have all those sensors coming into some sort of a localized gateway that crunches a lot of data, is a little bit higher power and is able to ingest the data. And then sometimes that's not enough and you need to pass it to a co-located data center, which is a regional data center where there's additional compute done. Or sometimes you need to pass it all the way back to one of the large data centers, regional, global regional data centers. But the point being is all of those are nodes, and to build a system that is efficient economically, you need to determine the right power performance per watt that you need in each one of those nodes and the right information you need out of the data out of each one of those nodes. And then you need to deploy that into a specific market use case. So let me give you an example that is very probably at home for a lot of people. Let's say you're at the store and you're in the wine section of a grocery store, and someone comes up and picks up a bottle of wine and wanders over to the produce section and snags one of those little barcodes off of the bananas and puts it on the wine bottle discreetly, and then wanders over to self-checkout, scans the wine bottle, and walks out with a, you know, $25, $30 bottle of wine for 84 cents, right? That is a very common type of loss that occurs in the retail space, or it used to at least. Deploying computer vision at that point of sale device is a form of edge compute that says, this is not a banana. You know, this is a bottle of wine. And let's say they were really smart and they got a bunch of bananas because they know that roughly 5 to 6 bananas is the same weight as a 125 milliliter bottle, right? And so they tricked the scale as well. So these are types of things that happen. And these are types of examples that I think people, just anyone on the street, kind of knows just intuitively about, or maybe has thought about. And this is an example how deploying edge AI to improve the information at edge nodes all around where we work, eat, sleep, and what we do, hopefully not sleep, but work and eat and play, can resolve some of these critical issues. And like I said, improve citizen welfare and improve the supply chain and improve the vendor's business model as well. So that's an example, I think, of edge compute that is a really reasonable, tangible one that I think a lot of people would resonate with.
And explain, you also mentioned IoT. Sorry, we're called explainable AI.
Yeah, absolutely.
Internet of Things. Sorry, I have to call it that, right? Called explainable AI. So,
So IoT is Internet of Things. It's an older term for connected devices. So think of a drone flying over a large crop of grapes and dropping soil sensors to determine the pH level of and moisture level, and then determining more accurate distribution of fertilizers in that field. That's a perfect IoT example. You have a drone that's connected. You have sensors that are connected to the drone that are just connected to some sort of a gateway, a little tiny, think of a little tiny computer that's hardened to be outside in a farmhouse, whatever. Or it could be, who knows, it could be inside, nice air conditioned, and it doesn't need to be hardened. And that's collecting that data. And then let's say you're a corporation that owns mini farms and you want to aggregate that data over your, 10,000 acres. And then you want to aggregate that data with your three farms that you own in the North or Midwest. And then you want to do that over, 18 months, and you want to track all the trends. So then you can better deploy and plan for the cost of your crops based on fertilizer and moisture and winds and predictability, and you integrate it with weather data. And, this is this idea of, big data and the advantages that come of it. So that is IoT, Internet of Things. It is the very tip of the spear with regards to incorporating and connecting sensors to compute nodes and turning data into information, and then turning that information into actionable insights that deliver value.
Excellent response. Yeah. All right. Paul?
With Joe, with smart waste management, obviously that's a huge factor, with the centralization of more people migrating to cities and just smart cities altogether, because at the end of the day, 20, 30 years from now, we're still going to be wasting, right? But it'll all be automated. So trash collection, everything will be automated. So how do we integrate in your mind, how do we start thinking with the end in mind now, with smart waste management and smart cities? Anything that's autonomous, it has a waste component to it. Yep. And it needs to work well or collaborate well with that technology to manage that waste.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of places. So let me just use one that I think is kind of interesting. A use case that I heard was actually built first over in Israel. Is when I first heard about it being built and deployed. They were having trouble, believe it or not, with dumpsters overflowing, right? So, no one's ever heard of that before, right? So happens all the time. And why is that? Why does that happen? Well, it happens because, it only gets picked up every other Thursday or every other Friday or every other Saturday or, once every whatever it may be. It's on a schedule. And, turns out trash is lumpy. And I mean that in the sense of it comes when it comes, and someone moves out and they're not going to call the trash company and let them know that, hey, I'm moving this week. So you might want to come twice, right? It just doesn't work that way. Infrastructure isn't set up that way at the moment. And so what was happening is they were actually having disease problems. And so with this particular area that had trash regularly overflowing. So what they did was they used existing security cameras. And I don't remember if they were private or public, Rohan, for your information. And they were able to just do a simple trash overflow detection algorithm that took basically no compute or very, very little compute. And they would send an alert to the trash service that would come when it was full. And it saved them time, I believe. The result was they came when it was full. And they did not come unless it was full. And so they had more accurate deliveries and more accurate use of their heavy assets. I mean, those trash trucks are expensive. They're expensive to maintain. They're aging. You've got personnel involved. And so the more accurate you can be with the extraction of trash, the better. And so that was an example that I thought was very useful. I would like to see it in a lot of the places I lived. In the U.S. as well, and that was several years ago. So it may be deployed in other places at this point. But that's an example of just, and this is what I'm going to answer your question, Paul, which is the deployment of AI in cities, waste management, and other things. What it really does really well, and this is actually into the future, right? This is in the future as well. Is it eliminates a lot of the mundane, and allows us to focus on the more valuable. So when it comes to trash, right, you instead of having a pickup every week or every 2 weeks, now you're having a pickup on just in time, right? As an example, and we all understand from an ops research perspective the pros and cons. So whether or not the municipality has the ability, or the government or the private trash company has the ability to flex to that or not, that's something to be explored. But I would imagine there's a lot of people on the finance side who are looking at CapEx and OpEx and are saying to themselves, yeah, I could actually, if we could figure this out and I could reduce my trips by, 30%, that's a lot of money, or maybe 20% or 10%, depending on the use case. That's a lot of money to be saved. And those are happier citizens that improve citizen welfare.
Yeah, definitely. And I think there's a lot of cities that could stand to benefit. I was in New York back in March of this year, and New York has always had a problem with trash, always. In the late 19th century, it was waste from the horses that would, that would travel people through the streets. And then we transitioned to cars and so on. But it's still
now it's pizza boxes, right?
So. That's right. You walk outside and there's trash stacked up as high as my door right there, on the sidewalk. And I just don't think, cities like New York have the capability to, because they're so dense, they just don't have the capability to manage all that trash. So it really is a problem.
Wouldn't it, here, just really quick, Paul, wouldn't it be interesting if that was made publicly and visually available? Just hypothetically, I don't know anything about New York. I don't know what trash problem they really do have or don't have, but wouldn't it be interesting if they were able to at least have the data to show we literally don't have the fleets to pick up all the trash.
Yeah.
And we need this bond or bill or whatever it is passed on this general, in this general election in your local area, because here's the data, because normally there are trash in this area is unable to be picked up, or maybe it's a private entity and they say, look, we have to raise prices because we need to get 5 more vehicles. And you may be asking yourself, why do I need 5 more vehicles or trash trucks in this area? And here's why. Because over the last 90 days, 90% of the trash has been overfilled and running out. And do you really want that? But once again, the citizen involvement, the information, the transparency of the data, which is one another big key, in AI, is the transparency. The transparency of this data is going to drive more engagement. And it is so hard to find a negative to more citizen engagement and understanding as to what's going on around them so that they can have a voice and engage appropriately with both their local and state and federal and national governments, depending on where they are.
Excellent. Cool. So smart city means smarter citizens. All right.
I sure hope so.
All right. Hey, Joe. So thank you so much for attending as a guest on Explainable AI with us today. Both Rowan and I, we thought you made some really, really great points and for our listeners. And so it's been a pleasure. But I'd like to, as we wrap things up, I just like to give you an opportunity for any closing thoughts. If you're open to it, if there is a way for our listeners to get a hold of you, who knows, maybe have you on one of their shows or podcasts or interviews or something, how could they get a hold of you?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Paul. So, just some quick closing thoughts, as it's been extremely enjoyable speaking with you both. I think the fact that you have this podcast, the focus of this podcast is incredibly important. And so kudos to you guys for identifying the need and delivering the valuable content. I'm honored to be a guest on your show. Can you get a hold of me? I'm on LinkedIn, Joseph Mayberry, Joe Mayberry specifically. If you look on LinkedIn, that's the best way to get a hold of me. My information is available there for contact.
Fantastic. I hope everyone got a chance to write that down. All right, so this has been a pleasure, and I need not say more other than that if you're a listener and you would like to get in touch with myself or Rowan, as far as I'm concerned, you can get in touch with me via LinkedIn, Paul Anthony Claxton. You'll find me. I don't think there's any other Paul Anthony Claxons on LinkedIn. Contact me via my CV, which is www.paulclaxton.io. And I'll let Rowan, I'll let you close out with the last, and we'll say goodbye.
Yeah, you know, Joe, this has been absolutely fascinating because seeing the deployment of AI and how we're thinking about it for smart cities, and the combination of different technologies that they're using. And so I think you did an amazing job of explaining, again, explaining to our audience in real world terms and scenarios, how all that comes together. So I really, really appreciate you doing that. So that's been really, really awesome. If anyone would like to reach out to connect with me, I'm very visible online. Best place is go to rohanhall.com. So my first name, last name, you can see it on screen. Rohanhall.com, and you can reach out to me through that. You can also find me on LinkedIn at just Rohan Hall. Do a search and you can find me. So thanks, everyone. I hope we were able to create some really great value for you guys, not just in technology this time, but I think as well in how our city works, which I've learned a bit that I did not know. I did not know they had this much access to us. But it's been really, really awesome. So thanks again, everyone.